Now we're recording.
All right, man. How you doing?
Hey, Dustin. I'm doing all right, man. Been a busy holiday for me. I mean, it was like crazy. I don't know about you, but I had like family, just people I hadn't seen in years, all converging in my little humble abode over the holidays. And it was amazing. Not the least of which because, as I'm sure you felt in your neck of the woods, it got cold in December. I mean, really cold, especially over the Christmas holiday. And so Christmas Eve and Christmas Day were like below freezing. It was in the 20s, and it never happens here in Florida. So, but that had the amazing side effect of Christmas Eve and Christmas Day were the best skies I have ever seen. But since I've been here.
And oh, yeah. It was stable here, too.
Yeah, it was butt cold. But we went out, and we I pulled out the behemoth, and we saw all, you know, all the – not only was the sky clear and still and dark, but it was – we had Mercury to look – I'm sorry, Mars to look at, Jupiter, Saturn, and Orion Nebula. It was just – an amazing night. So
Mars through that 20-inch daub that you have is incredible too. Especially when the skies are stable, you can get a lot of magnification on it. It is incredible.
Oh, it made me so homesick for Colorado because it was the first time I had seen skies like that since I left. And oh my God, it was just, you just don't appreciate really cold, still skies, you know, if you haven't seen them in a while. When they come up there,
we're spoiled. Here. We don't really get the cold, either one of us. You know, I didn't get it in San Diego. I don't get it in Alabama. You don't get it in Florida.
Nope.
And most of the country gets real weather. You know, we're spoiled down here.
Oh,
but they also get those clear, crisp skies when it happens, too. And there's nothing better.
That's right. I mean, the in Colorado, the days after a front had moved, a cold front had moved through, usually in January, something like that, dumps a bunch of snow, gets down to -3 degrees or something, and you go outside. I mean, your nose hairs are freezing, but you got to go out because those stars aren't twinkling. They are they are ready to be imaged, viewed, whatever. So it was a
And it helps too that Colorado is one of the most beautiful places on earth.
It did. It did help.
You know, and I think that. Right there between like Colorado and New Mexico, that area, you know, Southern Colorado is, it's so tough to beat the skies out there. And Colorado has a lot of dark skies even still, but it has lost. I've heard from so many people, it's lost a lot of the dark skies it's had with just the development, the explosion of population in the major cities there.
Oh God. Yeah. It's, I mean, in towns like Boulder where I lived, most of the time, unfortunately, while you do have clear still nights, what you mostly have is a lot of airflow over the mountains. And so you get a lot of mountain waves and things like that built up. And so seeing was never in Boulder anyway, less than 5 arc seconds. But if you went up just a half an hour up to say, I don't know, Chautauqua or up Boulder Canyon a little bit, you were out of that and you could see some really clear skies. So it wasn't that far away, but you're right. Denver, Boulder, the whole metropolitan area is just awash in light now. It's really sad, but that brings me to something I want to talk to you about in a little bit. I want to talk about lighting here. I have some questions for you, but yeah, just to finish this topic, I was, you know, really reminiscent of some of the best skies, you know, here in Florida, which you never get because it's always moist and hot.
Right.
And there's always clouds.
Humidity makes it tough, right?
Yeah.
All that water vapor ends up above you and you're looking through it. And especially when you have a big telescope, like the one you have there, you know, you can get, when it's stable, you can get just about anything you want visually to be just sharp and crisp because you put so much magnification on it and still get good resolution.
Mm-hmm.
But with bad skies, when you have that moisture in the atmosphere, man, you're just magnifying those heat waves and the atmospheric disturbance. And that's all you end up seeing is just something jumping around in the eyepiece.
I know. If I weren't living here in Florida, Charlotte and I have talked about this, we would probably move to New Mexico, just because that's I lived there in '82 when I was working in Alamogordo, and it was that it had skies similar, and it got cold there, surprisingly enough, even though it was a half hour away from El Paso. It still got pretty cold in January, and the skies were pretty amazing.
Yeah, northern New Mexico is amazing, man. Mm. I love
this was in the south.
I love that whole area.
Yeah, Las Vegas, New Mexico, and they have these up by Taos is also really nice as well.
That's where you're getting into the territory where it's so dark, the Milky Way is casting your shadow on the ground.
One of the few places, man. God.
Yeah, it's good stuff out there, and especially if you go when it's cold, so you don't have all the snakes everywhere. Man, I hate snakes with a passion. Yeah. So I don't belong in those areas in the dark when it's warm out.
Landers had quite a bit, didn't it?
Oh yeah, man. They've got those rattlesnakes that they're infamous because they're supposed to be worse than any of the other rattlesnakes in the country. The green Mojave rattlesnakes or whatever they're called, man, those things are intense and aggressive, but I just don't like snakes at all.
Yeah. Yeah. Here, the one to watch out for is cottonmouth. And on my property, we also have coral snakes, but luckily they are very recluse. And so you don't see them very often. Charlotte had 9 cats on our property at one point because they just ended up on our property and we took care of them. And we lost one to a coral snake bite because they play with them, right? That's Ooh. Like very bad idea. And so it was we lost one to that, but we know they're out there. We just leave them alone and they leave us alone, but I don't like
yeah
them. If they're out there, just stay on your side. I'll stay on mine and everybody gets along. Yeah.
Well, man, I have been using the last month, I've been using one of Ioptron's new mounts, CEM70G. So instead of German equatorial, they're kind of like center balanced equatorial mounts. But they, it's a slightly different design, but they are, I'm telling you, it's one of the things I've been most impressed with recently of any of the equipment I've used. This thing is, the guiding is impeccable. I'm getting the best guiding out of it I ever have. So it has the guiding, basically an auto guider built into the saddle. So it's rigid, right? There's no flexing because it's built into the saddle. So where the saddle goes, it goes. And so it comes in the mount. It's literally just like when you plug your mount in, you can just connect directly to a guider. It's already there. And the same thing is true of electronic polar alignment. It has something called an eye polar in it. And it has completely changed the way that I've started doing setup and teardown. And I didn't know if you'd seen these yet. Have you seen these or played with any of these yet?
No. So I'm going to put a picture up on the video version of this, but yeah, I don't know what you're talking about. So describe it to me.
Yeah. So, you know, a lot of the mount companies have changed and made things a lot easier for everybody, which cables are an absolute nightmare for any astrophotographer.
Amen,
I hate
brother.
Cables with a passion.
Yeah.
And when I see the cable mess of any system, it just stresses me out. because that's going to be the thing that destroys the entire imaging night when one of those cables comes down and gets caught on one of the knobs on the mount or something, and then this telescope tries to slew, and then it rips the whole thing out or damages your camera or whatever happens. But what mount companies have started doing is putting in built-in USB hubs into the saddles of the mount. So now the saddle has not only on the Ioptron anyway, it has not only the guide camera, which is mounted to a 120mm scope inside the saddle, but also it has your electronics running through it so that your cables can be really short. I mean, I'm talking 4 or 6 inch cables that only go from, say, the camera to the mount. And the saddle even has power distribution, so you can run a power cable to the camera from the saddle. So you have nothing hanging down. So when the scope moves, all the cables move with it, and nothing's hanging down where it can get, it can get damaged or get snagged on something and end or ruin the imaging night while you're sleeping. Or just, even if you're awake and watching it happen and just devastated as you watch it tear your system apart.
That's one of those things where you wonder, why haven't they done this before? You know, this is this is long overdue. That's really great.
Oh, yeah.
And cable management it's one of the most underappreciated parts of owning equipment, I think. You've got to have good cable management. Otherwise, like you said, you pull stuff out, things stop working, or you get cables get wrapped around over the course of a night.
There's nothing good about having those long cables hang off either. No. I mean, even on a small lightweight system, which is what most people are using anymore. It's like when you're in certain orientations, you got 30 pounds of cables hanging off in one direction.
Jesus.
It's throwing your balance off and everything every time you slew.
Well, so you have so much equipment, you have that problem. I've never had the quite 30 pounds.
It's not really. I'm exaggerating. I'm exaggerating a long way. But, you know, it's it is a lot of cables that end up on those systems. I mean, you've got multiple cables for the camera. You've got filter wheel and focuser. And, you know, sometimes people even have like the AO or, you know, your guider, just a lot of cables in general. And then the mount's got to be powered. But running everything. So if you power the mount below where anything's moving, and then it has power distributed to the top, and you can run cables just from there, then obviously, you know, it's going to save you a lot of trouble and a lot of pain. And your cables are going to last a lot longer too, because they're not getting snagged on things. I'm really, really impressed with how it's worked and just the guiding accuracy and everything that I'm getting out of it. Cause I didn't know what to expect. It's the first one that I've used of their new systems, but it's definitely one worth looking at. And all of their CEMs, you know, from, I think it's the 40, 45 up or from the 40 up have options like these. And so they go all the way up to 120, you know, 120 pound payloads. But it's really, really impressive, man. I'm talking about guiding on very long exposures. That's just phenomenal.
What's the drive system like? Is it worm gears?
So they have multiple. These are traditional gearing, but they also just released a harmonic drive system, which, you know, right now is a really kind of hot. It's a trending type design for good reason. It really should be. Counterweights are another thing. If you can get rid of it, why wouldn't you? You know, you get more torque from a harmonic drive. They're very consistent. And, you know, they deliver a lot of power. So you can have a very small system that, you know, because of the shape of the oblong gear and the flex spline in a harmonic drive, you get more teeth engaged at any given time. And you get that consistent torque where you don't have to be perfectly balanced, and you can have heavier payloads on a lightweight mount without counterweights and, you know, still get really, really great results because they don't have, you know, the backlash issues. So it's really, I mean, harmonic drives are a new popular thing, but it's for a good reason.
Yeah. But this isn't one of those.
They have both.
They have both.
Yeah, they have both. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
So they've offered, you know, ZWO also released a harmonic drive recently. They called the AM5 that's been extremely popular and people are taking incredible, incredible images with. And, you know, they're getting these mounts into packages that are under $2,000. And these are professional systems. I don't know how else to say it anymore, but the gear has gotten just so good. It's not that long ago. You know, when I started at OPT, the only harmonic drive mounts that were available were from a brand called Kronos. And they started at like $200,000.
Whoa.
You know, just way outside of the range of what anybody's going to put in their backyard or take on a road trip. And these things were huge. And now, you know, you're getting great harmonic drive, you know, or strain wave drive for $2,000. It's just insane what everything has come to, how all of this gear has all of this new, you know, potential for professional imaging at a price that everybody would have laughed at you if you told them that it was possible 10 years ago. They just said that's never going to be possible.
Yeah. Wow. So what you say, this is an equatorial mounted system, so you don't need to worry about things like field rotation. This is aligned to the North Pole.
Right.
Right. So,
yeah.
But it does not have counterweights. I need to see a picture.
The CEM. So the center equatorial mount or Chinese equatorial mount is what they have it listed as. That one, the center balance one I told you about is still equatorial, but it has counterweights. Okay. It's only the ones that are a harmonic drive that, you know, they say you can use to a certain payload without counterweights.
And that's just because they've got a better contact with the gears and they can support more weight, right?
So yeah, it's just the gearing structure instead of all the gears being, you know, just a couple of gears engaged at any time. I'm not sure if you're familiar with harmonic drives and how they work.
Not really,
but it has an oblong gear inside a circular gear, and there's a flex spline between the two. And so as the oblong gear rotates, it pushes that flex spline into two contact points with a lot of teeth engaged at both sides and creates a ton of torque out of the system. So they can be extremely consistent because there's pressure against it. There's no backlash. And then periodic error is an issue in these mounts, but you know, the software, you can do periodic error correction, even if something is cheap and I mean, it's free as you know, PhD2, you can do periodic error correction in the mounts. And now you've got virtually a perfect mount for, you know, very low cost without having to do a counterweight. So they really are very effective, and there's a reason they're so popular.
Yeah, that's what I was about to ask about periodic air. And that's another thing that has advanced, I think, a lot, because before you just had to live with stuff like that, you know, stuff that was in gears, you just had to, but now software is out there to correct even for that. So as you say, you have perfect tracking on some of these things. So I never found counterweights that onerous. In fact, I kind of think they were, you know, they really were good to have a nice balanced system. You had to spend some time doing it, but I don't know, never seemed that bad. Really,
it's not bad, but I mean, you spend a lot of time in observatories. You know, it's bad when you're traveling and you got to carry around. If you have a relatively large system, you got to throw them in the car and get them out every time. Like, it can be cumbersome.
Yeah, they aren't very portable. I guess that's true.
Yeah, so. they can be annoying. And the first time you drop one on your foot, it changes the way you view counterweights.
Yeah, that's true. Or you kick them after you set one on the floor.
You don't like them nearly as much. You don't care about the balance of your system.
God damn it. Yeah, well, the idea of the power distribution, too. Talk a little bit about that. That's interesting to me.
Yeah, there have been a lot of products that have been very successful in this. You know, Pegasus became very popular with their power box, where it's exactly that. It's power distribution and, you know, a USB hub where you can eliminate a lot of the power cables. You power this and then power everything else off it so that you can put this in, you know, a spot on the mount or on the telescope that's out of the way and prevent all that cable drag and everything else and eliminate a lot of the cables. So, or at least the power supplies. So it's been very effective, and there are multiple companies doing it now. You know, Prima Luce has the Eagle, which is their computer that they offer, and it does the same thing. It has multiple ports that you can power everything off of the computer itself, and even ZWO's computer system from their Raspberry Pi devices, you know, their Airs and such, they have power distribution on some of that stuff too. So there are a lot of companies doing it now because they realize how much it helps the person in the field or out, you know, doing the imaging to have that as an option, to not have to bring all the extra cables and to have things just much smaller, compact, and not, you know, ruining your night. Because I'm telling you, man, it really is the culprit on most ruined imaging nights. It's either a cable that's gone bad from being dragged around, or a cable that snags and then ends up tearing something up.
I know. I have gone through so many USB cables that have been laying on a wet, you know, dewy ground all night, where they just get rusty and corroded.
It's so tough on them.
Yeah. And presumably there's enough power in there to run most cameras
I'm running a QHY 600 and a Z on my other one. I'm running a ZWO 6200. And both of those, I mean, those are big full-frame sensors, 62 megapixels. It's actually the same sensor in both cameras. And it's running my systems beautifully, you know.
What's
and I've got
typical power usage of these cameras?
Oh, I don't know. Off the top of my head.
Do they use the thermoelectric cooling a lot, or do people just not use that?
I leave mine running.
That's the biggest draw, I would think.
I leave mine running 24 hours a day, too. So it's always running. And like right now, it's sitting in the observatory running and staying cool. So, you know, I know that it can handle it, but I like to kind of pressure test some of these things and see, you know, how far we can push them, how they last. And to both companies' credits, both of those cameras, I mean, they've been running for a very long time and they're both still excellent. They look great. The sensors look great. The cameras haven't been phased. So, I mean, these products, they're making great products, but, you know, I've been super impressed. It's one of my favorite new things I've used is that Ioptron mount. I still love my BISC mounts. Don't get me wrong. Like the MX Plus and the ME2 is what you've seen out in my observatories. Mm-hmm. And those are world-class systems that, you know, software BISC has produced.
They're multiple thousands of dollars. Yeah.
They're very, very expensive compared to, you know, it's like the Ioptron mount, of course, that we're talking about is $2,000. Whereas an ME2, is, you know, a much bigger capacity. I mean, it's like 240 pound capacity, but it's got, you know, it's going to have a $17,000 price tag on it too. So we're talking about two different realms as far as pricing goes. But I'm getting phenomenal results out of both. I can honestly say that.
That's cool. That's how much does it weigh, the one you're using?
The 70. So the 70 is the capacity, but as far as the weight of the mount itself, I'll have to look. You know, they also offer it with encoders, which is really cool. It does basically double the price of the mount if you get encoders on both axes. But
what does that get you?
I mean, it's still pretty cool. One of my friends just got one. He got a CEM 26, and he got an encoder on the RA axis, and it's unfair watching him run his system. You know, Ian and I were imaging with him, and watching him run, his guiding is just like nothing you've ever seen before. It's an unfair advantage.
So the encoders give you much more accurate guiding.
Yeah. There's a lot of discussion and even, you know, a little bit of back and forth in the forums about whether or not, you know, they're necessary. And I mean, my mount, I got them without them because I guide, and generally the guiding, especially on these mounts, is so good that you're going to be at or below the scene conditions anyway. But if you have the encoders, it's, for one, it's super reliable. You know, it's always going to be more precise with encoders than it would be without. So if you've got the cash for it, you might as well get encoders. It's going to be a better mount. But for people that are like, I'm just going to get encoders so I never have to guide, I don't recommend that. I mean, there are things that just happen through an imaging night where I think it just makes guiding so easy. It's one button, like just guide. Yeah. Even if you have encoders, it's still going to be better, you know?
Well, didn't you say the guide scope's built in, or what was built in?
Yeah, the guide scopes are built into, so it's an option. It's not something you have to get, but it's an option called the eye guider that's built into the iOptron mounts.
Okay. And do you have that?
Yeah, but like for instance, my mount weighs 30 pounds and it carries 70.
That's not bad. That's not bad at all.
Yeah.
So, okay. And the does it come with tripods and stuff, or do you need to do that?
Oh, no, yeah, this so you is... can, I mean, these packages are basically, there's a bunch of different options when it comes to iOptron specifically, where, you know, you can get it with a tripod, without a tripod, because a lot of people are putting these in observatories now because they have all the observatory features like a mechanical home position so that, you know, if the power cuts off or whatever, you can home the mount and now it knows where it is and then go back to imaging because you're going to be doing plate solving anyway. And so like this is a mount that I'm using in one of my remote observatories, which before, without all those features, I wouldn't have been comfortable doing that because I'd be worried I'd have to go out there to fix it or reset it or something like that all the time. But their mounts now, I mean, you can do this. And it's not just iOptron that's making these super high quality mounts. I mean, Sharpstar just released a harmonic drive mount I haven't had the chance to use yet, but I'm dying to get my hands on one because it looks awesome. But the iOptron is just one that really, really took me by surprise. Not because I didn't think they make great mounts. They've been making really innovative and cool stuff for a long time. But I just had no idea it was this exceptional.
Yeah. I bought one of their very first mounts. It looked like a blue cube. And I bought this guy, it must have been 2005. And it was a little lightweight go-to thing that mounted on a tripod. And I loved it. It had a little dovetail on the side where you could put small telescopes. I used it for my PST H alpha telescope for a while. So
yeah,
it was nice. They've been around a long time. I even recognize the name. So
yeah. So. It's and you know, I get excited. I'm guilty of being excited about gear pretty much all the time, you know, about everything.
I can't imagine why. What's the deal with you anyway with this?
I love that part of the hobby, but I can tell you that you know, after I got mine, I was using it in the backyard, and Ian, this was when Ian and Kat were living with me before they bought their house. They were here house shopping, and Ian came out and he was watching it run. And the next day he was like, "Hey, I bought one." So you bought what? He said, "I bought one of those mounts." And then it was like a week later, I was talking to Kat and she's like, "Hey, I bought one." And so now when you go into the remote observatory, there's three of them sitting there in a line because I was like, you both got jealous. You both got jealous one night of imaging.
Oh, that's probably a drill downside to hanging out with you too much is like, you know, you end up with all this.
I'm not the only one guilty of it, man. They do the same thing. Yeah. They're always buying and using cool equipment. And the stuff is just so good. I know I say it just about every single podcast, but it's like, if you're a camera lover or just a photography lover, it's like you live in you're here the exact right time to be alive because cameras, just how fast they're getting as good as they are. It's just unbelievable what you can do with them anymore. The images people are taking are just, it's such a huge difference from what it was 5 years ago.
Yeah. I mean, and it's just, I guess it just keeps moving exponentially in terms of developments and innovation. So, I mean, it's hard to keep up. I'm glad that's what your job is to keep up with all that stuff.
Yeah, no, well, I love it, man. I love it. I'm even when I'm not, you know, working, it's like the gear is what I spend a lot of my time digging into, because I just think it's awesome how far this stuff can be pushed. And the industry has really incredible people pushing it. You know, Skywatcher just released a new mount too that looks awesome.
I love their stuff. I love their stuff.
They're awesome, man. That's what your scope is a Skywatcher.
I know. I'm biased, but I also have their little tiny what do you call that, Star Adventurer thing too. I like that too. So
yeah, Kevin Legore, I mean, everybody at Skywatchers that I've met is awesome, but Kevin Legore really stands out in the industry as a whole for being one of the people that I think has really led the charge for just taking on the mission personally. You know, he has Focus Astronomy, and just taking on the mission of outreach and trying to reach as many people as he can to just spread the awareness and, you know, the fact that this is even possible, because people still not only know, the people that do hear about it don't believe it. You really kind of have to see some of this stuff to believe it. And I doubt there are many people in the country that have done as much outreach or put as much effort into it as Kevin Legore at Skywatcher, one of the people that's you know, putting out these products. But it helps that, you know, people like that are designing and making these products. That's why they work so well for imaging and driving the hobby forward.
Yeah, yeah. We had him on the podcast too, really long time ago. So check back on our archive, folks, and you'll see the episode with him in it. So, well, I guess that leads me to a question I've been wanting to ask you about the night sky.
Okay.
So it's cool to have, you know, one of the cool things I get by meeting with you every week is I can think about something and then I'll say, I wonder what Dustin thinks about this. I want to ask you about LED lighting, street lights in particular. I've been noticing as I drive around everywhere that they are becoming everywhere. And for those of you who don't know, the advantage of sodium vapor lamps, which are those orange ones that you see, used to see everywhere, lighting up our streets, were that they were in a very, they released light in a very narrow band of wavelengths that you could filter out relatively easily with astronomical filters. Even though they did contribute to light pollution, at least you can filter it out. LEDs now are the thing, and I support LEDs. I think they're great because they use a hell of a lot less energy to light up the area, but their wavelength ranges are much more difficult to filter out. And so I wanted to get your opinion on this. Have you noticed, first of all, more LEDs in your area?
Yeah. I mean, it's obviously becoming more and more popular everywhere, and that's tough on astronomers.
It is. Have you been adversely affected by it at all?
I mean, it's hard to say. You know, I think the easy answer would be yes. You know, that's the surface answer. It in the form of like sky glow's only going to get worse, you know, with these, especially with LEDs pushing out this light. But it's tough too for, you know, for professional astronomers trying to get their measurements. I believe it's specifically in the blue channel where, you know, these LEDs are cranking out this light, right? It's right along one of the things, and I should know exactly what it is. I could probably find it in 2 seconds, but right along, spike around 460 nanometers disrupts astronomical measurements directly by creating brighter night sky via sky glow. So yeah, it's tough, man. I mean, it's controlled still in a lot of areas, especially areas where, you know, the night skies are regulated and how much light pollution can be there, but I don't see it going away because people want that efficiency and they want the longevity of these LED lights, you know?
Sure. Like I said, I'm a big supporter of installing them, but the problem are two things as I see it. One is the wavelength range in which they're being installed. They could probably be tuned better, I think. And they use full cutoff fixtures, which is really good. Full cutoff means that it shines the light down to the ground instead of letting it leak up straight overhead. So full cutoff fixtures are definitely a good thing for reducing light pollution, but they're also very, very bright. And even the reflected light off the ground is brighter than what you would get from the previous lamps. And of course, the wavelength ranges are the same, depending on the surfaces, I guess. But still, it's a problem with reflected light in bouncing back up into the sky after it's been released. So I think that this is something we're going to have to look at, I think, a lot more closely. And I've noticed it here where I live. They're replacing a lot of the street lamps to the extent that Florida puts them up. We're very infrastructure light around here. They don't put up a lot of these things, sidewalks, things like that. But where they are installed, it is bright. And I mean, it ruins my night vision in an unbelievable way. I mean, just walking down through a light lit street, it's like a car dealership, only worse. And some of them have been malfunctioning. Once they've been installed, they've been going purple. They've been shifting even into the bluer wavelengths. I guess ultraviolet, because they end up with some kind of purple hue in some of them. So it's something to look out for, I think, in the future. The night sky is under assault in so many different ways, and this is just one other thing that I think we have to worry about as amateurs. And I think about it a lot. I just wanted to get your thoughts on it because...
Yeah, you know, and it's not something I probably should know more about each of the different light types. I just hear a lot more about it, you know, honestly, I'm hearing more about it regularly from other astrophotographers and from people associated with like IDA, the Dark Sky Association. But, you know, I've got a quote here just by searching that one thing you asked. The first quote that I see says, "The steady global conversion to white LED lighting, especially for streets, is the biggest problem we have confronted in the 27-year existence of the Dark Sky Association." Mm-hmm. And that was John Barentine. He's the project manager for the IDA. So, you know, clearly it's an issue. And the people here in the comments are talking about exactly what you just described. You know, the street lamps coming down are very bright, but what happens is it gets reflected from there. And they're saying, especially after a rain, it's like, it's a nightmare how much light gets reflected upward and causes problems.
The light domes around cities. Now you go out, let's say you do go to St. Landers or somewhere out in the desert, and you have personally great skies directly at the zenith, but you look around the horizon and you'll see these light domes all over the place. Those are just going to get brighter due to this effect. So it's something to be aware of. I don't know if there's anything as amateurs we can do about it, but you know, you as a manufacturer of products like the Triad filter, mm-hmm. aren't you worried about this kind of thing? Because you got to worry about your band passes, right? You block out most light pollution with the,
that's it's the hard to block point. Out LED. Yeah.
Yeah. So yeah. What do you think that you don't sound worried about it.
And that's why, you know, we're very thankful for organizations like the IDA, that are addressing it directly and consistently. But there are a lot of things. There are a lot of things we're worried about. I mean, we're worried about, you know, Starlink and other things too. It's just the world is changing and it's going to continue to change. And there are a lot of benefits. The answer is not just to shut everything else down. It's not, you know, to stop Starlink.
I wasn't advocating that. I just wondered if you thought much about the problem itself.
It's tough.
It's
really challenging because it's, you know, it took a long time to get to a Triad filter. There was a lot that had to be done in filter manufacturing to even be able to produce multi bandpass 3-nanometer and 4-nanometer filters, just to be able to produce them in the first place, you know. And then once you're there, you've got this product that can cut out a lot. It can do a lot for you. I mean, that product really changed the way a lot of people imaged, and it made color cameras look a lot more appealing as well. A lot of people started using color cameras with the Triad filter and the Triad Ultra. But yeah, with LED, I mean, it's a much more difficult problem, as we experienced, if you remember, when we were in New York doing our imaging in Times Square, when we set up those telescopes.
Yeah.
I mean, we could cut through enough to see that something was there, but you were not going to get a beautiful image from there because it just, you'd have too much light coming into your system, you know, too much noise.
I think I'd like to see a controlled test done. This would be interesting to see with the Triad filter. If you could take some, I don't know what you would take images of. I guess maybe sky gradients of some exposure time under sodium vapor lamps, you know, not directly under a lamp, but say in a backyard that might have some in the vicinity versus another another backyard that might have LEDs in it, and test the performance of that filter to see if it is affected any by those wavelengths of streetlights. That'd be an interesting thing to know. I'm sure, like you say, you can't filter it out entirely. No filter can, but it'd be interesting to see if LEDs have a detrimental effect on.
They're definitely the toughest, and there have been a lot of people that have taken those filters, and I've seen it on some of the different forums and on Facebook and in those groups where people have done tests with them. And, you know, to try it, if you're in normal, I say normal, if you're in skies that aren't just getting beat down with it, most of the time you can cut through it to where it looks like you're out somewhere very dark. With a filter like the Triad that's 3 nanometers, 4 nanometers, you can cut through a lot. But if you've got directly above you an LED coming at you, man, you're in trouble. Yeah. You're in trouble. It's going to be really hard to shoot through that.
If you're a listener that has a Triad filter and you have experience with this, I'd love to hear it. Let me know. OPT podcast. I'm sorry, Space Junk podcast at deepastronomy.com. And let me know, man. I'd like to know how it's affecting you, only because I know as a visual observer, it's affecting me. And so I'm so worried about our night skies. You know, it's like, I'm terrified that they're, you know, I have granddaughters now and I want them to experience space the way I did, and they're just not going to be able to.
And I think that's the real question, right? Is that we can keep pushing the boundaries with technology. We can keep finding better, more sensitive cameras, better filters, all these different processes to cut through and to kind of mitigate those issues. But what do you do about visual where one of your control sources is gone? Like the human eye only has a, you know, a very limited range of exposure time, and you don't get to set it manually. Right? Yeah. Like what do you do when you can't use those types of filters because you can't change your exposure time, and what you see is what you see, and you got what, a 30th or a 60th of a second to see it.
Yeah.
What do you do?
I know. That's why even me as an old codger who's not only do I have limited ability to see, you know, my exposure, my frame rate of my eyeball, but it's also getting older and my retina's getting more, you know, everybody gets cataracts regardless, but you know, they're also performing less over time. So
man, I was still laughing yesterday about you measuring your age in proximity to Andromeda.
Yes.
Back when Andromeda was further away.
That's right.
And we couldn't get good images of it, man.
Yeah. Well, it's so many things are taking away my enjoyment of the night sky. You know, I'll tell you, one of the best things that I have here in Florida, and I wish I could figure out, maybe you can help me with some technology answer to this, but the best night skies in Florida, the darkest skies that you can get is out in the middle of water. If I go into a big lake, in the middle of a big lake, the sky is really dark.
And how do you stabilize
that? And wouldn't it be great if I, because I have a houseboat, it's not a big houseboat, and it does rock, and it does swing. It's the swinging that gets you. You know, what can we, you know, that's a great platform, at least in Florida, for looking at dark skies. They're readily accessible to me in the in 30 feet of water. But you know, everywhere else it's there's where there's land, there's people, and there's street lights, and there's everything else. So,
yeah. And it's a shame, right? Because if you could stabilize that, you'd have the best skies.
I know.
How do you do that when you've got, you know, the giant alligator in the water next to you in the Everglades, slapping the telescope with its tail. And, you know, you got waves coming in, all that stuff, you know, I was at a technology conference a couple years back, and there was this this company that had this platform that was making adjustments at something insane, like 1,000 hertz. And it was a big platform, and it was made to put, you know, big, heavy things on. I know, like these insane numbers. And I asked him about that. I said, you know, so all joking aside, does this mean like if we put a telescope on this thing, we could image it in a situation like that? Like, could you image this in water? He's like, on this thing, you could image through an earthquake, you know? And he was dead serious. And he's like, but at 1,000 hertz, you could image through an earthquake.
Well, sure. And, I mean, even if you're on a boat that's rocking at, I don't know, some couple of hertz, let's say, this would be a much faster frame rate or sample rate that you could compensate for.
Right, you could make those corrections, and it would stabilize. I don't know, like, how does that work, though? It would have to have a long swing in order to allow the system to stay flat, you know, on something like I think that it'd be a lot better with small vibrations, like maybe harmonic vibrations moving through a building, than it would be like a big ocean wave.
Yeah, yeah. Now, to be fair, my houseboat, if I'm sleeping out on it at night in the middle of a lake or an inlet somewhere, the water is actually quite still. And if I put two anchors out, I could keep the boat from moving around too much, but it's still the walking around the boat, the shifting weight on it. It's all of that. It's like trying to observe on a really bad deck, you know, that's super wobbly. Yeah, yeah. So
you're not going to be imaging from the boat, I'm afraid.
Yeah, no way.
You could probably get some good views with like some wide angle binoculars.
Oh yeah, I definitely do that. I bring the binoculars out and lay out on the deck and use those most of all. Just because the skies are so dark, I can't help but just enjoy it.
If it's still on the water, I could see that being a really enjoyable experience. Not even like that disorienting or anything. If the water's, if the water's pretty still.
Yeah, it's like glass. I mean, I only boat in the rivers and inlets and creeks and stuff around here. I don't go out into the Atlantic or the Gulf, so it's not that big a deal. But I bought a Starlink antenna, you know, the internet thing from SpaceX. I bought one of those and put it on the boat, and it works great. But it's always slewing, that little dish. Yeah. So it's even if the boat is anchored on both sides and not really doing a lot of transverse motion, still the shifting of the weight on the boat causes it to recenter and has to find the signal again. So it's slewing quite a bit. So even then, so I know a telescope wouldn't work. I'm just saying it's too bad because that's where the dark skies are where I live.
Yeah. Well, it is. But you know, that's another thing. Like, speaking of binoculars, like that's where those things come in handy. There's so many astronomer lovers that don't have a set of binoculars, and it blows my mind. And even more than binoculars, like a small spotting scope. Yeah. You know, that's what I use. I use it all the time because it's so easy to grab and go. It has like the little built-in tripod that just stays on it all the time. The thing weighs nothing. Mm-hmm. But if there's something, if the moon looks cool, or if I go out and I'm just like, hey, look, let's scan around the night sky. It's so easy and quick to do with binoculars or the spotting scope that I find myself doing it all the time, where I'm not going to go grab a system and set it up to go, you know, look at it visually through a bigger telescope. But with binoculars, man, it's like it's something that every astronomy lover should own, is either binoculars or a spotting scope. I use that Universal Astro one that you saw when you were here. Mm-hmm. I use it all the time, like probably 6-7 times a week.
Yeah, I have one too. That little 70 millimeters, really nice. So my problem with binoculars is I just get tired of holding them. So I would definitely want to put some kind of, you know, tripod under them if I'm going to, because I lay on the deck and I'm looking up with them, but my arms still get tired. Mm-hmm. And 10 power is the most I can hold it still for. Anything higher than 10, I can't see anything. I'm jiggling around too much.
People try to go too big with handheld binoculars. Yeah. You know, it's like that's where spotting scopes come in handy, is they have that tripod where it's like a stand, you know, that is going to stabilize it for you. But with binoculars, I agree with you. Don't worry so much about the power. Get, you know, big aperture, low power, and go out and just scan the night sky. And it's amazing what you can see.
Yeah, I think you'd like 7x50s. They're going to be big, but and somewhat heavy. But the 7 power is plenty for Jupiter and stuff like that. And 10, I think it's just too much. I have a pair of 10x35s I use for bird watching, and that has a real wide field on it, so these happen to be pretty nice. But that's the biggest I'd go is 10 power,
right?
So, well, all right. Well, I guess so. Something to watch for, folks. If you got any experience with using your triad filter, especially, I'd love to know what your experience is with LED lighting. If you've noticed any difference or whatnot. So, I don't know. Okay. Well, what do you think, Dustin? Have we got an episode here, or do you?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
All right.
This is fun. I'm glad we're doing this, and we'll keep it going. You know, I'm going to be using some new equipment in the next week. We're finishing up the first observatory, and this probably won't surprise you, Tony, but they are starting on the second one on Monday.
Okay.
So there's another one going in 10, well, it's 15 feet from the first one now with 11 more piers.
Wow. I got to see this. I got to get over there.
Yeah, you got to get up there.
Cause I haven't been there since you've done all this. So
there's a lot of Astro going on here, but that's what happens when you get, you know, Kat and Ian and Tagback TV, and we're all here in the same area. Two other friends of mine that are just as obsessed, if not more, all in the same area.
Why don't you hit some of these people up and let's talk to them on the podcast. Let's just, okay. You know, they don't have to stay long, 5-10 minutes, yeah. Just tell us what they're doing. And it'd be good to hear from them again. I think a lot of people would be interested to hear about what's going on with Kat and Ian
for sure.
And Sean. Yeah, so yeah, since they're all right there. Cool. All righty.
Yeah. I got a friend too, that I should probably bring on here because he got the bug really bad. He just quit his job actually. And I mean, he had the kind of job that most people chase forever. He got it, and he's going all in. He's like, I just want to work with telescopes and do stuff in space and in the space industry anyway. And he's going all in. So he's one of the peers that's in the observatory. But it'd be fun to kind of hear his story too, because it's fascinating listening to him talk about it. He was inspired actually by Bray, who we've also had on the podcast multiple times, close friend of mine. Bray Falls. Bray has become one of the best imagers in the world, by the way. Anybody that's listening, if you haven't seen Astro Falls' work, go look at the images that this young guy has produced. I mean, it's some of the best work I've ever seen in my life, and I think he's just raising the bar in a lot of ways.
So. Yeah, I agree. I keep track of what he's up to as well. So definitely check him out, folks. He's definitely somebody to know if you're just getting started, for sure.
Right.
Okay. Well, yeah, definitely hit them up, man. I mean, they're just, hey, okay, get over here. Yeah, go on over and let's talk to Tony for a few minutes.
Will do.
All right, buddy. All right, folks. Well, that's it for this episode. I'm Tony Darnell, and Dustin Gibson is the other guy. The other guy. All right. Thank you so much for listening. And as always, keep looking up.